We now proceed to look at geology, and then a little cosmology. There are two geologies. There's deluge geology and there's modern evolution geology. For centuries it was believed that Noah's deluge had laid down the great sedimentary rocks which cover most of the earth. Then came a new geology, evolution geology, popularized by Sir Charles Lyell, L-Y-E-L-L. Lyell's new geology was based on evolution, and a geologic column was devised. This geologic column became the keystone of modern evolution geology. But the geologic column is not a real column. It's a mental image only. You can't dig through it. It doesn't exist complete in any part of the world. What you do find are some of the expected strata, usually very few of them, with strata missing, and worst of all, with strata in the wrong sequence. The Grand Canyon of America is regarded as the showpiece of the geologic column, but it has strata missing and strata reversed. A big part of the Precambrian is missing. All the Ordovician and the Silurian are missing, and some of the Devonian is missing. Then, at the top of the column, the top of the column is entirely missing. There are no Triassic, Jurassic, Cretaceous, Tertiary, or Quaternary. All told, more than half the theoretic column is missing, and the missing strata add up to 1 billion missing years. Also, you'll find two sections of the Grand Canyon where strata alternate, several alternations, backwards and forwards in time. And really, you know, alternating strata are impossible in evolution geology, but these strata alternate. So that's the Grand Canyon, the showpiece of the geologic column. Rather than being a showpiece, I suggest that it's an embarrassment. When the theoretic geologic column was applied to rocks around the world, it met impossible problems, like upside-down mountains. In Switzerland, the Great Matterhorn Mountain is upside down. By fossil dating, the mountain is old, but the rocks under it are young. Now, how can that be explained? Well, it's explained this way. The enormous Matterhorn Mountain must have been uplifted somewhere else, and then moved horizontally across country for 60 miles and left sitting on its base of younger rocks. Another famous mountain, the Mython Peak, is dated older than the rocks below it. And to explain that, it was claimed that this mountain was thrust all the way from Africa across the Mediterranean Sea into Switzerland and set down on top of the Alps. Breathtaking. I could quote many examples of this, but we've time for only just one more example, the Lewis Overthrust of Montana, USA. The upper mountain is dated 500 million years older than the lower mountain. To explain that problem, you're told that this mountain mass, 500 miles long, thousands of feet high, weighing 800,000 billion tons, and containing some of the most glorious scenery in the world, all this must have been uplifted in another place and then slid across country for at least 35 miles, or 55 kilometers. Common sense says that these things cannot happen. The field evidence shows that it definitely did not happen. But when the theory doesn't fit the mountains are forced to fit the theory. Evolution geology is contradicted by very many things found in the wrong rocks, like modern human skulls found in Pliocene rocks, like an excellent hammer with handle of wood and head of steel found in rocks supposed to be 400 million years old, like the jawbone of a child found in coal supposed to be 30 million years old, and in other coal, two large human teeth, an iron pot, and a nice gold chain. And yet again, in Utah, in Cambrian rocks, there are human footprints along with trilobites. But Cambrian rocks and trilobites both ended 500 million years before mankind began. Recently, there have been finds of trees and plants, including flowering plants, in Cambrian and even in Precambrian rocks, ages before trees and plants supposedly began. Now this is extremely important. It proves that trees and plants did not evolve, and that the geologic column is a myth. Evolution geology cannot explain polystrate fossils. These are mostly fossil tree trunks which protrude through several strata of sedimentary rock, sometimes through 30 feet of rock and more. Yes, more, like the great tree trunk in sandstone near Edinburgh. It's over 80 feet long. It intersects 10 or 12 different strata at an angle of 40 degrees. Can you imagine any tree waiting during millions of years while the sediments were built up strata on strata around it? Polystrate fossils are fatal to evolution geology. They show that sedimentary rocks were laid down rapidly and by prodigious water action. Polystrate fossils have been found going through several seams of coal, and that contradicts the idea that coal required millions of years to form. Also remember that human remains and human artifacts have been found in coal. And regarding oil, in the Gulf of Mexico and in New Zealand, carbon-14 has dated oil deposits not at millions of years, but at only 6,000 to 7,000 years. Furthermore, scientists in the laboratory have converted garbage into oil within 1 hour, and have converted garbage into coal in several hours. The real facts testify that coal and oil were formed recently and were formed quickly by the dumping and burial of enormous amounts of organic matter by great flood waters, and that rules out the supposed Carboniferous Age. There's compelling evidence for the deluge. We know that the mountains of the world have been underwater. The rivers were once huge. The Thames in England was 300 feet above sea level. The Caspian Sea was 250 feet higher and was joined to the Aral Sea and the Black Sea in one big inland sea. The Dead Sea was 1,400 feet higher. The Grand Canyon must have been scoured by waters 20 miles wide. The deserts of Australia were inland seas. The Sahara Desert was fertile and populated and was watered by rivers and lakes. How different today. Our planet Earth has dried out from a world flood. Dramatic evidence for the deluge are the great fossil graveyards which are found around the world. They contain multitudes of creatures of all kinds, jumbled and mixed together. In Sicily, 4,000 feet up on Mount Etna, there are two caves crammed with the bones of giant hippopotamus. Near Los Angeles, there's a death pit with tens of thousands of specimens of all kinds of living creatures. The Cumberland Bone Cave in Maryland is stacked with mammals and reptiles and birds from all regions, cold and warm, dry and wet. In California, in an area of 4 square miles, a fish graveyard contains something like 1 billion fish in death agony, showing that they were trapped and buried suddenly. There are many dinosaur graveyards containing masses of dinosaur bones piled up and mixed up and buried together. Those dinosaurs were washed there with great violence. Many are the fossil graveyards, but greatest of all the fossil graveyards is that of the Arctic around Siberia, and it defies description. Buried in the frozen tundra are innumerable creatures, including tropic animals in this frozen wasteland, lions, foxes, camels, and millions of mammoths. Something like 5 million mammoths are buried in that icy waste. A few of them are so well preserved that their flesh could be eaten by dogs after thousands of years. Fossil graveyards are compelling evidence that an era of the world was ended with enormous violence and by water, by the deluge, a worldwide flood caused not so much by rain, but by the fountains of the great deep, fearsome volcanic activity, bringing juvenile waters flooding up from the depths of the earth, upheavals of ocean beds with great tidal waves, and oceans flooding continents. And from the heavens, rain, rain as volcanic dust flung into the upper atmosphere precipitated a probable vapor canopy up there. A vapor canopy which many competent people believe existed before the deluge. If the deluge did happen, then the fossil record must be reinterpreted. If there is any rough sequence of fossils in the rocks, it's not an evolution sequence, it's the sequence in which creatures were buried in the flood sediments. If the lower rocks contain fossils of trilobites and simple sponges and sea worms, it's because they lived down at the bottom of the sea. They would have been the first to be buried by the flood sediments. Free-swimming fishes would be trapped later, then the amphibians even later, because they lived higher up on the level of the land. Then another factor would become effective, streamlining. Simpler animals are streamlined, and in moving waters they would sink faster than would complex creatures. So the simpler would be buried lower than the complex. Finally, for the highest animals, there was the escape factor. Birds could fly, and higher animals could flee to higher ground. They would be the last to drown. In the deluge, the sediments would be deposited rapidly, trapping and burying the living creatures. The sediments became rocks, and the creatures became fossils. It means that the fossils are mostly creatures that lived at the same time, when the flood struck them. Whether they were trilobites or dinosaurs, or mammoths, or monkeys, or man. It means throwing out the geologic column, and we're led back to deluge geology and a young Earth. But you may object, what about radiometric dating? Doesn't it prove that the rocks are as old as 4.5 billion years? Radiometric dating is founded on three assumptions which are not valid. The first assumption is that uranium, or potassium, or rubidium, decays in a closed system. A closed system is an ideal system, and this is not possible in the rocks. The minerals would be subject to contamination and leaching and mixing and evaporation and other spoiling factors which make dating impossible. The second assumption is that radioactive decay rates never vary. But decay rates will vary if cosmic radiation varies. And cosmic radiation has certainly varied because of decay of Earth's magnetic field and because of supernova explosions in nearby stars. In the words of Dr. Frederick Duneman, the effects of such supernova explosions would knock our radioactive dating measures into a cocked hat. The third assumption concerns the measuring of the lead found with uranium and the argon found with potassium. It's assumed that none of the lead, or none of the argon, was present when the rocks were formed, and this assumption is quite reckless. Radiometric dating depends on those three assumptions, but if your basic assumptions are not valid, then you can't get reliable dating. Perhaps if we had some rocks of known age, we could test radiometric methods. In the sea near Hawaii, there are basalt rocks which were formed 200 years ago. The potassium-argon method was tried on these 200-year-old rocks, and it gave ages of 20 million years, 160 million years, and even 3 billion years. Then for other rocks from other parts of the world, the uranium method has given ages of millions and billions of years, up to 5 billion years and even 10 billion years for rocks that are known to be young rocks. Then the moon rocks brought surprises. Rocks from the moon should be perfect subjects for dating. But the uranium lead method and the potassium argon method gave the moon rocks a spread of ages varying from 2 million years through 2 billion years and 7 billion, 8 billion and even 28 billion years. 6 times the supposed age of the moon. Then space probes have discredited potassium-argon dating. The potassium-argon method depends on yet another assumption, namely, a reckless assumption, that the ratio between argon-36 and argon-40 is now, and always has been, exactly the same ratio as is measured on Earth today. Space probes revealed that very different ratios prevail on Mars, where there is too little argon 36, and on Venus, where there is much too much argon 36. These findings knock out the very foundation of potassium argon dating. Now here's a trade secret. Dating by fossils will always take precedence over radiometric dating. If a radiometric date is seriously discordant with a fossil date, the radiometric date is usually disregarded and usually will not be published. The discordant radiometric date is usually explained away by some invented geologic disturbance or by some invented heating effect or weathering effect, and without any evidence for the invented explanation, then the radiometric date is discarded and the fossil date is retained. You remember I discussed Skull 1470. The potassium argon method was used on volcanic tuff adjoining the skull. First, Cambridge University Laboratory gave it a date of 221 million years, which was far too much for the evolution story, so it was dated again. Next time, Cambridge Laboratory came up with a date of about 2.5 million years. Then the University of California got a date of 1.8 million years. Richard Leakey decided to give the skull an age of 2.6 million years. At this point, an expert in pig fossils objected that the 2.6 million years was not concordant with the stratigraphic age of some nearby pig fossils, and Leakey then reluctantly dropped the age of his skull to a bit less than 2 million years. But that's not the end of it. The Cambridge Laboratory then tested several more samples of the same tuff using potassium argon and got a variety of ages ranging from a mere 290,000 years up to 19.5 million years. It's been well said that radiometric dating is a clock without hands, a clock without even a face. At this point, I'd like to make a very brief comment on the idea of drifting continents. You know that continental drift, or plate tectonics, is a fashionable theory at present. But remember, it's still only a theory, or a hypothesis. In my book, The Crumbling Theory of Evolution, I try to give a fair assessment of plate tectonics. Well, there's not time to do that on this tape. But as we've been dealing with radiometric dating, let me mention this much. A fatal objection to plate tectonics is that the hypothesis depends on potassium-argon datings of the ocean bed. We've seen that potassium-argon dating is generally hopeless. But undersea potassium-argon dating is so disastrous that the evolution establishment itself has issued a warning cautioning against using potassium-argon for dating the ocean floor. Yet despite this, it was on the basis of some potassium-argon datings of the ocean floor that the hypothesis of plate tectonics won popular acceptance. We haven't time to talk about several other serious objections to plate tectonics or continental drift. Let me just say that Dr. Henry Morris has pointed out that there are still some outstanding Earth scientists who oppose the idea as being geophysically impossible. And he says there are some signs that indicate that the pendulum may be starting to swing back. Just be on your guard against plate tectonics. And now carbon-14 dating. Carbon-14 is useful for short-term dating of organic material, such as bones, wood, coal, oil. Theoretically, it's claimed to date up to 40,000 years, but there's good authority for regarding it as unreliable beyond 3,000 or 4,000 years. The Geochron Laboratory in America won't use it beyond 3,000 years. Carbon-14 is produced by cosmic rays in the upper atmosphere. The dating method depends on one word, equilibrium. Equilibrium between production of carbon-14 up there and its decay down here on Earth. Cosmic rays acting for 30,000 years should bring about this equilibrium, but there is not equilibrium yet. Walter Libby invented carbon-14 dating. He found 20% non-equilibrium. But he believed that cosmic rays have been acting for much, much more than 30,000 years. So he called the 20% experimental error, and he assumed equilibrium. However, it's now known that the non-equilibrium is real. It's nearly 40%. Dates should be corrected for non-equilibrium. Another factor is this. The Earth's magnetic field is weakening. As we go back in time, it was progressively stronger, more and more shielding out cosmic rays and reducing carbon-14. Furthermore, the deluge would have upset the carbon-14. All these factors make carbon-14 dates unreliable. Beyond about 3,000 years, they become progressively exaggerated. After about 6,000 years, they become more and more meaningless. So when you read that man was in Brazil 30,000 years ago, and that Aborigines were in Australia 40,000 years ago, question the dating. Then comes the question, is the Earth old or young? The billion-year ages have grown out of two ideas. First, the assumption of evolution, and second, radiometric dating. If these two are found wanting, then so are the billion-year ages found wanting. On the other hand, there are many natural phenomena which limit Earth and universe to only some thousands of years. We'll take the non-equilibrium of carbon-14 production and decay, which I just mentioned. If equilibrium should have been reached within 30,000 years, well, it's fair to conclude that cosmic rays were turned on much less than 30,000 years ago. And that indicates that the universe itself is only thousands of years old. Then there's the Earth's magnetic field. It's decaying rapidly. Professor of Physics, Thomas Barnes, has studied the Earth's magnetism for years. He has pronounced that the decay is exponential, with a half-life of probably 1,400 years. If we project this decay backwards in time, 3,000 years ago, the magnetic field would have been four times its present strength. 7,000 years ago, it would have been 32 times as strong. 10,000 years ago, it would have been an impossible strength. Barnes claims that this is evidence that the Earth is less than 10,000 years old.